Okay, we're back. Welcome to the Linux Show for Tuesday, May 20th, 2003. Jeff's not with us again this week, but I'm here, Kevin Hill, and we have Doctoral, Arnie Fuentes, and Russ Pavlicek, as usual. And we'll be getting into the news of the week, and we'll be having a guest in the second half, as normal. So I guess the big news this week, we might as well jump right in, is the SCO versus IBM lawsuit. Who wants to jump in on this one?
What do you other guys jump in while I look for something? This is Doc.
Well, Kevin, let's not forget, too, our special guest for the first half as well, Dennis Powell. Hello, Dennis.
Hello. Greetings. I would love to jump in on the whole SCO business, except for the fact that I'm not real sure that I could fit it into the first half of the show. There is so much to be said about it. Has anybody else here actually met any of the SCO guys? Because I have.
I met a couple of Caldera people a couple of years ago at Linux World Expo. But
I met pretty much the whole crowd, including their. Intellectual property guy, they're SCO source, and Darl himself, and I just gotta say, we are talking Nixon administration.
True, I think so. I Blake Stoll, when he was at Caldera and then at Linio, was a really good guy to deal with.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed dealing with him when he was there. He's one of the holdovers. And I see these things coming out over his signature, and I actually thought, you know, there was this quote from Ransom Love that Don Marty shared. He's the editor in chief at Linux Journal. I said, our model is to innovate, give back, and innovate again from August of 2000. I thought, he must be spinning in his grave. Oh no, he's not dead. It's sad.
I never I thought I'd hear this. I always liked Ransom.
And I did too.
Yeah. I didn't like what he said, but I always liked him. He was basically a good guy, and I think he had the basic right idea about open source and free software.
Caldera did a lot of early development for which they got very little credit.
Yeah,
a lot of it went to Red Hat. And
but you know what? I had this feeling that someone was managing him, because he would say the most god-awful things sometimes, and you wondered whether, you know, this was him talking, or was there someone pulling his string a bit, and you know, there was always a problem with Caldera. There was always things that they were saying and doing.
My own feeling about that is that, you know, Caldera's DNA comes to some degree from Ray Norda, and you know, who has just been Captain Ahab against Microsoft for a long time.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you look at the money that he spent to kill the great white whale over and over again, and now he wants to go after IBM, and that's sort of like the weird thing. I'm not even sure that Ray is actually involved in this, but it fits the pattern. I mean, they bought DR, you know, DOS.
If you follow the sorry path of Unix as SCO defines it, there is so much cross pollination within that company when it owned both. It's really difficult to imagine that the lawsuit thing and the ridiculous action of SCO last week withdrawing its Linux distribution, or suspending. Does anybody actually think they're ever going to come back? And so on. They really ought to be suing themselves.
Their Linux distribution will come back when their company comes back. And I'm not holding my breath on either account.
When the Weather Channel begins to cover hell.
Yeah, it's a sad case. It's a sad case. I mean, they were a minor player, and they're getting a lot of airtime. I hate giving them the airtime, actually, in a way, because I think this is one of those things. It has such a trolley feel to me about it. You know, I mean, what is going to happen? You know, it's like it sucks up lots of sound and fury, but. You know, does it actually make any difference? You know, I mean, suddenly we're having an intellectual property argument. Oh, fuck. I mean, why have those?
Well, that's true until we find money with Microsoft's name on it showing up at SCO, and we don't know how much, and we know the reason supposedly given, but
we don't know the time frame, and we don't know the course of events that gave rise to that money.
Yeah.
Well, the question for me becomes then, you know, is it possible that Microsoft and SCO could be as successful in their strategy against Linux and open source as, say, the record industry and Hollywood have been against file sharing, and you know, but by basically getting illegalizing it and. I mean, and that's an area where the bad guys have won a great deal. But this is an area where the bad guys, I don't think have the marbles. I mean, I don't think that there's any track here.
I think there is, and I'll tell you why. Microsoft's big deal is FUD. That's how they killed OS 2,
yeah.
And they did it really well. They do not care about desktop users, whereas the music industry cares about you and me. Microsoft doesn't. Microsoft cares about enterprise things, because desktop users are going to go buy a computer, they're going to get a Windows license, period. You know,
yeah.
with very few exceptions, they're going to buy Windows. Whether they use it or not is no concern to Microsoft, and probably they just assume they didn't because it cuts down on tech support calls. But,
well, here's an interesting thing. I got an email today from a guy at a university who said at his university, right now, Microsoft has a new strategy, which is give away the tech support. They are offering license extensions to universities at discounts with this damn cell phone's going on there. Just kill it off. There we go. They're giving away they're giving away the tech support, and they're winning that way. And it's a very quiet thing.
Very similar to what they were doing, that we found out they were doing last week in terms of European licensing. That if governments or businesses were thinking about using Linux, they would go so far as to give away Windows just to get them or keep them.
Right. All right. I know that Microsoft has hugely deep pockets.
Holy.
But how much can they do that before it starts hurting? And why would they do it in the first place unless they were being hurt by, say, Linux, BSD?
Oh, they are being hurt. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, a lot
of... They can't afford to give it all away.
but they can afford to give some of it away. They don't want to give it all away, so what do? They cast fear, uncertainty, and doubt. They make it more difficult for an IT guy to go into the president of the corporation and say, you've got to take Linux seriously.
Especially since every single student at every technical university is going to be shown the Microsoft path, and probably only the Microsoft path.
Yep.
And the CTO of the university is going to say, oh, wow, we got this great deal with Microsoft, and so this, we have no reason to support Linux. Of course, in the computer science department, they're going to be preaching a different thing. But in the computer business end of it, what they're going to do, and this is what's happening at Cal Poly. At Cal Poly in Pomona there, my wife works there, the business department is all Microsoft all the way. And in the computer science department, of course, there's an entirely different thing.
Well, interestingly enough, at Caldera Systems, Inc., it was, and later Caldera International, it was entirely a Windows shop except in the development section, which is probably something that they would not be real happy to have generally known, but I know it to be a fact.
Well, yeah, every press release they ever got was, you know, manufactured by, you know, Word or something.
Yep, and if you check the headers, you'll find that it arrived via Outlook.
Right.
And so yeah, that's a little embarrassing too. But what, you know, the goal here is really to cast upon Linux an air of disreputability, which, you know, I mean, Microsoft's tried to do that, and everybody said, well, of course. But now, if you have an inside player doing it, somebody who had a distribution who says, we are dropping our distribution because we think it might be illegal, I mean, that's a pretty heavy-duty piece of FUD.
But who's to gain by that illegality?
I can't believe anybody believes it.
The whole thing stinks, and basically, if you read Eric Raymond's paper, or if you read David Morings, who's a frequent visitor to the Linux Show IRC channel, either one of those position papers on the SCO versus Linux thing, both of them are excellent papers, and you know the idea is doesn't seem to be a leg to stand on. Now I haven't heard any argument that would rebuff either one of the open source arguments that I've read, the good ones.
The only stuff that I've seen has had to do with the 64-bit stuff, and whether there's anything there or not, who knows? And to some extent, who cares? I mean, that can be blown out of the kernel so fast your head would spin. But there has been some speculation that there might be a little dab of something there. But now that's in large measure entirely different from this whole Linux may be illegal thing. And interestingly enough, if you go to the ftp.caldera.com, you'll find that they still have everything there available for download.
No. Yeah, you can download Caldera Linux, and it's all free. And by the way, and if Linux is illegal, their SCO should sue themselves.
Yes, and Ray Norda actually, because he at one time, of course, owned both Caldera and what has become SCO Unix, and was publishing Caldera stuff under the GPL. I mean, he was giving it away when he owned them both. And it seems to me that pretty well would set the precedent right there. But who knows?
Yeah, there's a lot here that just is just really weird. There's going to have to be. It's going to be interesting to see when they finally say what the bits are. It's going to be interesting to see the proof that they originated it. Number one, because there's so much Unix intellectual property flopping around that predates Linux, you know, having to do with the BSDs and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That is all fair game. It's going to be an interesting task just to prove that SCO was indeed the originator of a lot of this stuff, and not just another benefactor of this stuff. The other thing frankly is kind of ticks me off a bit is when I see some of the doom and gloom type articles out there about what an impact this will have on Linux if the case is proven, I'll tell you there's a much more significant impact that will come around. I don't know if I mentioned it last week, but I'm going to repeat it regardless. And that is that if this turns into the club that can beat back Linux legally, number two, I would tend to think that would probably a club that will be purchased by an organization which has a reason to beat back Linux, and I'll leave that to, as an exercise to the listener, the worst case scenario is that, quite frankly, we end up in the U.S. with being somewhat crippled in our Linux advancement because of this club, but the rest of the world goes on and develops more in the open source world, and within the decade we become essentially the boat anchors of IT.
Sic transit gloria mundi.
You know, it becomes like the French Minitel system, where it was a grand advancement at the time, and now it's holding them back frequently from the internet. That's the situation. That's the worst case scenario as far as I'm concerned, is that if this stuff is successful, it's not going to hold back Linux in the world. It'll hold back Linux and open source in the U.S. potentially, and end up holding back the U.S. itself as we can't get on the next wave. That would be the worst case scenario as far as I'm concerned.
That's very likely so. I wonder what the effect that it would be then on the BSDs, whether we would see more of a migration to them.
That'd be an interesting question. That'd be a very interesting question.
I don't see BSD benefiting that much from this as much as I just don't see this coming out really well for SCO. I just don't see it happening. I mean, what I see is this being an absolute. I mean, this is like. This sounds like the dirge is playing. The dirge is playing already. I mean, there's. You know, I think the fat lady's singing for SCO, and I think they're in big trouble. And I think this is a Doc, and you characterized this. It this way that it's they're really on their last legs, and this is a last desperate reach for
it entirely fits the pattern of a parent company shaking down big players for money. You know, it's a shakedown operation. I think we should treat it like that. I think it means nothing other than that. I think that I've thought both ways about IBM, you know. And on the one hand, you know, should they have come out more sternly in the first place to say this is absolutely baseless or not? But actually, they did do that, you know.
They did say it was baseless.
They did say in the first place it was baseless. I don't think they want to dignify it with anything more. They've got buildings full of lawyers that are pulling it apart, and I think Eric and Rob are doing a great job of giving them some offline help and others in the community, and it's a silly case by a desperate company. And
what's interesting is that IBM isn't doing the nuisance lawsuit thing that they might customarily do with such things. You know, toss them a few bucks and they go away. I see
that would be bad.
I think they know that would be bad. I think they know that it's such a frivolous case, and I mean, this is, you know, possibly the biggest patent holder in the world, right?
Yep.
I mean,
yeah.
They've got people all over this thing, and it's not, you know, they're not going to lose. I doubt very much that they are going to give them any money to go away. Or if they do give them money to go away, it'll be exactly that, and there will be another word said about it, and. You know, and that'll be that.
Well, IBM's got a lab that Nobel laureates have worked in.
Right, and I mean, if IBM does pay them something to make them go away, it'll be a strictly economic decision and be treated like that. You know, just make a cost-benefit analysis on what it's going to cost to litigate the suit and say, okay, is it going to take $100 million? Will he accept that? You know, will he accept 50? Something like that? Go away.
Yeah, and the thing is that the sense that I get from talking to people at IBM is that that's not even on the table.
I hope not.
I mean, they just flat intend to squash this like a bug and have done with it once and for all. Because among the alternatives then is everybody who ever wrote a line of code marching up and saying IBM stole my code.
Well, and
Yeah, right, exactly.
The other side of this, too, is that if IBM were to take the route of paying them to go away, they would still be in major trouble because they are relying on groups like Red Hat and SUSE to provide the software for the engines that they are selling. And SCO's already said that, that basically they're on the list.
Yep.
So paying money for them to go away from IBM just means that they're going to face the problem again with the next round of lawsuits because it will weaken their partners and that will in turn weaken IBM's business. So IBM has to go for a finishing stroke one way or another.
Churchill said it this way, you don't feed the crocodile with the hopes that he will eat you last.
It's true.
I mean, you know, and SCO's acting like a crocodile, and, you know, the object is don't feed them.
The other thing, let me just throw into this, too, this business about this petition of, hey, SCO, sue me. Robin Miller did a little piece on this over at NewsForge. There is something wrong when people go out of their way to bait a rabid dog. And I think that's what's going on here. People are venting, but it's really not a smart idea to dare SCO to bite them because they're running around showing their teeth and trying to bite. So, frankly, I don't encourage people to go up with that petition because I don't think it's a really good thing to do.
No, I didn't sign it.
No, it's, you know, and online petitions as well. I mean, you sign one when you'd like to write a letter but don't have time to. But I don't think anybody much feels like writing a letter to SCO.
No.
It's so pathetic.
I thought this last week that maybe there might be an opportunity for, no, I don't know, maybe I'm not a lawyer, so... But you know, maybe there was just, you know, maybe these guys are acting so bad and being such bad people that maybe just there ought to be some kind of class action against SCO for what they're doing. I mean, this is, it can't be legal.
Yeah, but stupid isn't illegal.
Yeah, and the other thing is, quite frankly, I really get the sense that they're basically upping their price is what it comes down to. They're showing off their intellectual property, showing their teeth, saying, hey, you know, this is valuable stuff. And, you know, I think part of what's being said here is now somebody offer big bucks and buy us because we're done here. We have nothing left but this intellectual property and our existing channels, which are beginning to slow. So this, to me, looks like a way of trying to increase the sales price for the company in the hopes that either IBM or Microsoft would come along and say, this is good intellectual property because of all the trouble we've been through. We'll buy it.
Well, they haven't been through the trouble. They bought it. And basically, they got SCO for bargain basement price, and basically, they didn't do the work. Someone else did the work. They just acquired it through a purchase. And basically, you know, I think you hit the nail right on the head, Russ. I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that SCO is nothing, and they are nothing. I think they're less than nothing.
Well, but also in connection with Microsoft buying them, that I don't think is going to happen. I mean, if you want to get the DOJ to come dancing over to Redmond in one quick hurry, all you have to do, if you're Microsoft, is buy SCO, buy another operating system.
I doubt that because, you know, they bought Corel, basically. They destroyed the Corel Linux offering during the proceedings.
Yeah.
And there wasn't so much of a bat of an eye.
Canadian company.
Still, you know, I mean, it was the major, at the time, it was being touted as the major alternative to their office suite.
Yep.
There's another issue, though, also, and that is, as far as Microsoft purchasing Caldera SCO, is that you know, I really don't think that, you know, this is Microsoft used to have the intellectual rights to that very operating system. You know, they had the Xenix is what they called it.
Right.
And they were also a...
It was the same stuff. It was later purchased by Skull.
Yep.
I mean, if you look at the genealogy of Unix, part of it goes through Microsoft as Xenix, and then Skull got that. Microsoft sold it off. And, you know, they had a major intellectual property already with it. So, hey, I don't see any problem. Microsoft buys it. No one's going to bat an eyelash.
I really think that they might, particularly if what part of what they inherit is a huge lawsuit against IBM, that threatens Linux. Microsoft, I think Jeff was absolutely right, and that is that Microsoft does not want a direct connection with this lawsuit. They're happy to dance around the periphery by buying rights to SCO Unix for an undisclosed sum of money at some undisclosed time, because that's not directly funding this lawsuit. But if, in fact, it were shown that Microsoft is involved in all of this solely so as to knock out Linux, that would be a real big problem for them, I think.
It's called RICO statutes.
Yeah. Yeah, it would throw out much of a settlement that was highly favorable to Microsoft, as we all agree. It would cause them a lot of trouble when I'm sure they think there are other ways of solving the problem. Again, as we saw last week with the European giveaway stuff, now if they can in some way influence SCO to do something that is, in some respect, I mean, is in any respect at least a long shot and arguably most likely suicidal to the company. To have built the company, to indeed have floated an IPO on being a Linux company, and then 2 years later say we're not going to publish Linux anymore because it's illegal, is just on a corporate level something very stupid to do. And so if Microsoft can somehow get this dying company to do their dirty work for them, I think they would far rather do that than buy anything that they don't have any special need for.
Yeah, the only thing that they could do, I mean, you know, I can't see any reason why Microsoft at this point, I don't see where Unix fits into their business plan. It doesn't, except for as a thorn in someone else's side.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense for them to have Unix now.
Well, the situation that I see, I guess, is that if, and this is a huge if the SCO suit were to begin to look like it was going to succeed, and SCO would basically have a tremendous amount of right and say over the traditional Linux businesses, then suddenly it's not a question of the technology, it's a question of control. And whoever owns that intellectual property then would own quite a bit of the market. And I could see IBM being interested from that standpoint, and that it would free them up to go about what they're doing. I could also see Microsoft being interested simply because then that would allow them to continue to hold Linux to the fire. But as a product set, that's not a Redmond thing. But in terms of a strategy, it could work. If, and that's once again the gigantic if, that this is more than hot air.
Yeah, it's the buyout argument I can see chiefly as being aimed at IBM. Any IBM settlement kind of thing, I think, would if the bean counter said you know, it'd just be cheaper to buy them than to deal with them. They might well do that. I don't see Microsoft getting involved. I don't really see much of anybody else getting involved in terms of the buyout. IBM has some some stake in that, and it could solve some of their problems to do that. But again, I'm not hearing even the vaguest suggestion. And of course, you know, when you're dealing with possible securities transactions, you really shouldn't hear the vaguest suggestion. But in any case, there's no buzz about that being in the cards.
Well, I think we've run that one through the ringer fairly well.
Yeah.
Hammered that one to the floor, as a friend of mine used to always say.
Yeah. Well, what about some other stories?
We spend on time, guys.
Okay. Well, anybody else have any other hot stories of the week?
I had a couple non-SCO stories. Fujitsu's doing some more Linux things, which is good. And I don't have the link in front of me right now, but it's on the Linux World, Linux Show site. And if you click through the Linux Show, that down the way is a Fujitsu story. There is one thing that comes close to being a clueless pundit of the week, and that is, and actually this is a positive Linux article, but Kevin McKean, who's the CEO of editorial director, CEO of InfoWorld Media Group, wrote the major editorial InfoWorld this week, and it's called The Linux Inflection Point, and it talks about, well, I don't entirely agree with this guy. I mean, he's talking about some things, and it's a well-reasoned article, except for one thing. He compares Linux today compared, his metaphor he uses is horrible, smoking cigarettes. Remember when smoking was cool? Anyone who lived through the 80s and 90s witnessed a remarkable transformation in attitudes about lighting up. And that's the metaphor he used for Linux today. And this guy, I don't know what he's smoking, but whatever he's smoking, Linux is far, far cry. It doesn't cause cancer like smoking does. It doesn't, you know, it's not addicting, you know. I mean, maybe unless you get addicted to reliability, I don't know. You know, this guy, it's a good article that's ruined by his metaphor. It's just a piece of junk, actually. You know, there's another equally good one in the same issue of InfoWorld by Chad Dickerson. It's called If the Glass Slipper Fits, where he used the metaphor of Cinderella, which is a more apt one. Even if Cinderella doesn't get the prince, I mean, it's still a good article. And I encourage people to go to InfoWorld and read those.
Guys, it's time for me to punch out. Enjoyed it.
Okay.
Gotta fly.
Okay. See you next week.
Oh, by the way, a quick one for any listeners who might want to contact me on this. I'm going to go to New York, where I'll be looking at the role of Linux in Wi-Fi in the big city. And I'm interested in any leads you could give me. So
this could be huge.
It's a very huge thing, because the nature of the city is one, and of the way the waves work. I mean, you can aim, you can literally ricochet your signal off one building to the other. It's pretty amazing.
Also, the fact that you can pop a Wi-Fi card into a Zorus and it just works.
There you go. So anybody who has any cool stuff to tell me about that, I'll be there from Saturday to Tuesday, and when we call in Tuesday night, we'll know more. Okay?
Cool.
Take it easy, guys.
See you next week.
Great.
Okay, anybody else have any other stories for the week?
Yeah, over at NewsForge, there's a nice little piece called Talking Pizza and Packets with Samba co-founder Tridge. And now, I know that a lot of people listening are probably well acquainted with the history of Samba, but there are undoubtedly many people who are not. And once again, if you're trying to evangelize within your organization, this might be a nice little piece to kind of show around to people. But it does talk about the history of the Samba project, how it came about to begin with, and it's a nice little historical piece as much as anything, as well as also giving us some look at some of the things currently in the fire.
Yeah, it's really amazing just how far the Samba project has come with virtually no documentation to go on.
Yeah, and what documentation there is, And frankly, just let me say as an aside that if anyone gets to hear any of the Samba guys at Linux World or other shows talking about the process that they go through, do it. It's very interesting to hear about. But yeah, there's no documentation, and the documentation that they do have is mostly wrong. And this is one of the things that they go into frequently, the number of broken calls that they have to basically, they have to provide, as they call it bug-for-bug compatibility. They have to break their implementation the same way the original is, so that it can communicate properly. It is really weird. But incredibly interesting to hear about.
Wow. Okay, well, any other stories?
No, that cleans
it's
me
been
up.
It's been a one-story week around here.
Okay. Now, this is SEO is basically eating up all the turf here.
Yeah, it's sucked a lot of the air out of the room.
Yeah, that's for
pretty
sure.
Pretty much it.
Okay, well, I guess on that note, we'll take a break and listen to some music, and we'll be back with our guests in a few minutes. So hang in there, and we'll be right back.
I'm a glum one. It's explainable I met someone. Unattainable, life's a bore. The world is my oyster no more. All the papers where I led the news with my capers now will spread the news. Superman turned out to be flash in the pan. I've flown around the world in a plane. I settled revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted. Still I can't get started with you. On the golf course, I'm under par, and all the movies ask me to star. Got a house that's a showplace, still I get no place with you. You're so supreme, lyrics I write of you scheme. Just for the sight of you, dream. Both day and night of you. But what good does it do? I've been consulted by Franklin D. And Greta Garbo had me to tea. Still I'm brokenhearted, 'cause I can't get started with you.
When I sell kisses at a bazaar, the wolves line up from nearby and far. With kings I've a la carte, but still I can't get started with you. To turn down with stretch from London to New York town. The upper crust I visit, but say, what is it with you? Oh, tell me why am I no kick to you? Always stick to you, fly through thin and thick to you. Tell me why I taboo those beauty columns at my advice. Though I was Miss America twice, still you got me outsmarted, 'cause I can't get started with you. Thank you.
of jazz clubs, I've been a star. Even put new strings on my guitar. So many tunes I've charted, still I can't get started with you. Across the ping pong table, I'm fierce. I even grew this wonderful beard. I come on like a swinger, but you don't let me linger with you.
Okay, we're on. And we're back.
And welcome to part two of the Linux Show for May 20th. And we are joined tonight by our guest, Seth David Schoen. Is it Schoen?
That's right.
Okay, I want to make sure I got the last name right. And Seth works for an organization that, if you've been listening to this program at all in the last several weeks, you've undoubtedly heard about, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And welcome to the show, Seth.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
And Seth, can you tell our listeners, I know that the people listening know about EFF, but how about educating a few people that may not know much about what EFF is and does?
So EFF is a nonprofit, member-supported 501c3 advocacy organization. We're based in San Francisco, and we're a civil liberties organization. And we have, trying to calculate how many lawyers we have on staff. That's a big part of what we do. Well, we have 5 lawyers in the office right now, not counting our executive director. So we do litigation, and we do educational work and outreach work. And we try to protect interests like free expression and privacy on the Internet. We've been doing that for about a dozen years. And it's a great place to work. It's really a good time.
Oh, that's cool. You know, it's interesting that years ago, most of the guys on the panel tonight can probably vouch for this too, it used to be that you could go into a technical career and just worry about technical things. And more and more of these last few years, we've found that technical things, especially with the rise of the Internet, frequently branch off into very non-technical areas like law, because lines are being crossed with the Internet all the time. And so other disciplines like law tend to come in and invade our turf. So suddenly we have this very unusual situation, or what used to be unusual, of having technical people having to become aware of what's going on in the culture, in the laws, and so forth around us. So so you folks at EFF do provide an incredible service in that regard.
I'm not sure that it's a bad thing for technical people to become more aware of the world around them. But I agree with the frustration that people feel that activities which they used to engage in, like free software development, are now seeming legally risky, and they feel like they have to spend their time feeling anxiety over the legal situation around their work.
Yeah, it's and I would tend to agree that, yeah, it's a good thing when we do branch out, but it's kind of sorry that we have to feel the absolute need to, rather than expanding ourselves naturally. Does the EFF have a particular stance about free software itself at this point, or is it just a question of some of the liberties that seem to come into play in free software development?
Well, we think free software is a good thing, and we think that free software is a place where a lot of legal issues that are important to us are coming up and becoming apparent. And in fact, there are situations where the fact that free software is free software creates some sort of legal or political issue. Just the fact that users can modify things. I can get into examples of that in the entertainment industry's political advocacy, where in some cases they actually have a condition that something is okay with them as long as users can't modify it, and as long as users can't add new features.
Right.
And so if you have software which is explicitly designed to be modified by users, that's something that may seem more threatening to some people in particular contexts. And it's not just entertainment industry.
It kind of begs the question, though. What good is software that can't be modified?
Well, you can... I mean, people have done lots of things with software that they couldn't modify. I think the usefulness is diminished, but I don't think it's completely eliminated.
Well, I mean, but the long-term viability is certainly diminished.
Well, yeah, in the long term, you have dependency on someone else if you're not able to maintain your own software, and that's a risky thing.
Yeah, it seems to me not the issue that software can't be modified, but software may only be modified by the, as it were, the chosen few who have already agreed to play by the rules of some of these other organizations. That's what the entertainment industry wants. They want people who will do essentially what they say to do with software and not rogues like many of the people listening tonight who actually go off and do things that that they want to do with software.
That's called innovation.
I think it's a disturbing vision, and I think it's a vision which has been explicitly articulated by a lot of people in the entertainment industry, that they want to see a technological world, at least the part of the technological world which interacts with entertainment work, that is based on sort of prior agreement, prior negotiation between entertainment companies and people who develop technology. And I think from dealing with them in a variety of contexts, I would say that the most radical people in the entertainment industries, which is a portion of the representatives of motion picture studios, are troubled by the idea of people just being able to make or modify technology on their own initiative and on their own say-so,
yeah,
without having a prior negotiation process and a prior approval process, if that's technology that's going to be interacting with motion pictures.
But the problem is that the way they do that is by taking and developing their own technologies, which they then try to lock behind a door that basically prevents supposedly people, and then when people inevitably go through the door, then they get all, they get their lawyers in gear.
I'm thinking, I think, at a slightly higher level of abstraction, which is to say that some people have a vision of a world in which the design of the technology is done, so to speak, by committee and by consensus. And it's not done by the individual technology developer. It's done through a negotiation. And it's true that the way that that's implemented is by creating technologies with particular properties and then pursuing particular legal strategies.
Yeah, it's a very different mindset about the whole creative process that goes on with this, because there's a different set of constraints that these people are working with. Now, we've talked a bit here just about some of the entertainment industries. What are the particular hot issues that EFF is working on now that might have some bearing to the free software open source world?
Well, I wrote a piece which was published in Linux Journal a couple of months ago, which was discussing an initiative that I've worked on, or I should potentially say worked against, called the Broadcast Flag. The structure of the terrain, so to speak, is that we have the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was a negotiation in 1998 and starting several years before that. And it was a negotiation between technology companies and entertainment companies about the what you might call the ground rules for technologies interacting with copyrighted work. And the bargain that they reached is one that's really bad for the public interest and really bad for innovation, but there was this deal, and when they make a deal, it's difficult to upset it. And
right.
We've tried to do something about that in court, and other people have tried to do something about that in court. Meanwhile, there are entertainment companies who are saying, the DMCA didn't go far enough. the structure of the DMCA is not sufficiently protective for our entertainment work. We need something more. We need additional legal protections that go beyond the DMCA. So in the DMCA, there is a structure where the DMCA speaks in terms of technical measures that control access to a work or that protect a right of a copyright holder. And the idea is that if those measures are what the Act calls effective, then you can't give people technology that defeats the measures. Now, effective is a very seemingly vague term, and there is a definition that's also somewhat vague that refers to the ordinary course of operation of the measure, which I read as when the measure is used the way the person who created it designed it. And I don't think it's a very good standard. But we have that structure, and the DMCA has a limitation, which is known as the no-mandate provision, which basically says that if you're using open standards, if you're using non-proprietary things, if you're using things which aren't technological protection measures, then you still get to do what you want. So it's Section 1201(c)(3) of the Copyright Act. And so, for example, if you have a document which is in an open standard format, and then you have an ineffective measure like a notice at the beginning of the document that the publisher only wanted it to be used in a certain way, the DMCA doesn't give that any particular force. And perhaps more significantly, it doesn't give the publisher the ability to go to a manufacturer of photocopiers and say, you have to make your photocopiers look for my notice. There is a certain burden which is placed on the publisher to create measures that in some sense actually work, that don't require technology to be redesigned specifically in order to accommodate them. And that's a form of consumer protection that's in the DMCA.
Mm-hmm. Is it being implemented, though, or is it being ignored?
Oh, I think that provision is being followed. Now, the trouble is that the DMCA is very broad, and the protections that are in the DMCA, in the face of that, are not adequate, but I think that that protection is something which people are respecting.
Now, we've
heard... If they weren't respecting it, they would be saying to the Mozilla developers, you have to rewrite Mozilla so that it can't download MP3s that contain a particular watermark. You have to rewrite your video drivers so that they can't display movies that are contain a particular watermark, things like that. They would actually be going out to the technology implementers and saying, we expect you to redesign your existing technology in a way that's more protective of us. And that's what Section 1201(c)(3) says that they don't get to do.
Now we've heard recently about some of these supposed super DMCA bills that are appearing inside some of the state legislatures. The EFF been involved with some of these measures that are coming around?
Well, the things that we call the super DMCA are not the measures that I was referring to a moment ago.
Right.
So the measures that I was referring to a moment ago are federal measures which are being proposed, which expand the DMCA in a particular, or expand the scope of entertainment publishers' control over technology in a particular direction. So that's distinct from the super DMCA. The super DMCAs are a collection of amendments to state law which create a situation which is analogous to the DMCA situation, but for access to or use of communication services like cable TV or internet service. And the MPAA, which is advocating those state laws, suggests that they're just simple sort of technical amendments to existing laws about unauthorized access to cable TV. And our analysis suggests that they're something very different and that they create new rights for communication service providers and publishers and create additional risk and uncertainty for people who are creating technology to do things that would traditionally have been considered legitimate. A kind of a particular example that we sometimes refer to is attaching a personal video recorder like a TiVo or a Replay TV or a computer that records video to cable TV service. Under one interpretation of the original bill that was advocated by MPAA, you would be prohibited from doing this unless you had prior permission from your cable company.
Wow.
So we don't want to turn around the default. We want to say people should be allowed to use technology unless someone can show that it's causing harm.
Right.
And I think the sensibility, the sort of intuition behind this legislation is that if you're interacting with a communication service, you should not be allowed to use the technology you want unless you've previously persuaded everyone else involved in the picture that it's all right, that it's appropriate.
We've been there before. We were there back in the late 60s when basically AT&T and Western Electric, and they were all the same in the Bells,
yeah,
all the same company.
An attachment issue about
and
the right
and in order to get
machine.
In order to connect your Apple II or your TRS-80 or your severe computer or your processor technology computer to the network, in other words, in order to connect a modem to the phone line, you had to first of all get permission. In fact, before connecting any piece of equipment that wasn't Western Electric, manufactured by Western Electric, you had to get permission.
Yeah.
And there were no telephones available except for Western Electric telephones. No one was selling telephones because you weren't allowed to own the telephone. You were only allowed to lease it from the Bell Company, who was the monopoly. Are we going back to that now?
I think it's worth mentioning that MPAA, in response to some of the criticism about this legislation, has issued a new draft of its model bill. And in the new draft, they add some provisions about intent to defraud and things of that nature, which seems sensible. On the other hand, I think there are still some significant problems. And I don't want to go down that path of the old attachment issues where you have to get prior permission in order to attach something. I think it's very important that people retain the right to... it's not just to go to a competitive market. I wanted to say to go and enjoy the benefits of a competitive market in the technology that they can use. But it's not just that. In the free software context, it's the right to participate in creating that technology. So it goes beyond that.
Well, we just had on last week Tom Liston of La Brea, and I don't know if you're aware of that situation, but basically he created an award-winning program that acts as a networking tar pit to basically foil network attacks on a server. And it got wonderful write-ups and so forth and was being very... very loudly hailed as an excellent means to keep evildoers out of your hair, but he became advised that that Illinois law now has a provision in it, according to its super DMCA, that indicates that basically you need permission to do things with network traffic, basically, the way.
Well, I had heard about that people who were developing applications like that were concerned about the super DMCA provision about concealing the origin, the place of origin or destination of a communication.
Yeah, and as a result, he's actually had to take down his software. He no longer distributes it through his Illinois-based website. Because he can't afford to have, you know, a team of lawyers look over the law and advise him as a free software developer whether or not this is legal, and number two, you know, if a challenge ever came to him, once again, he is just a single person, as most of us are inside the free software open source movement. We don't have the power to stand against some of these large commercial entities.
You know, I would encourage software developers who have legal concerns about software that they're writing in connection with legislation like this to get in touch with us. We can't always help them. We can't always represent them. But we try where we can to do something which is useful to them, which may be referring them to a local attorney who's worked with us who can give them useful advice. In some cases, if we think that an issue is important and we think that it's the right time and place for it, we may actually want to take it on as a court case. And that will depend on the particular issue and the context. But I would encourage people to get in touch with us. We actually do have at least 5 attorneys. We're bringing on a couple more attorneys in the near future. And they're real lawyers. And,
and they need the real money.
Yeah, that's very true.
And that's a big point here. Now, obviously, you know, if you folks are fighting the way you are, and you have these very good and learned individuals working for the EFF, obviously there is a need for funds for you folks. And how can our listeners particularly get involved and help you in that regard?
Well, there are probably a lot of ways. The most obvious thing is to say that if you go to our website, we try to make it very clear how you can give us money. And if you're in the U.S., your contribution is tax deductible for federal income tax purposes because we're a 501c3. I suspect you have to have a fairly high income before a donation is very significant to your tax return bottom line. But people have certainly deducted the gifts that they've made to us. We have a recent litigation victory, and it's really nice to have a litigation victory in a major case. It's a nice thing to talk about. It's a nice thing to experience. Certainly the lawyers involved are very happy. And that was a case where we had a client who, for most of the period of that case, was not a free software developer, but a proprietary software developer. The client has a variety of names, but is the publisher of the Morpheus peer-to-peer file sharing software. And we were successful in getting a court decision that, in that case, the publisher of that file sharing software did not have liability for how other third parties used it to infringe copyrights when the software publisher didn't have the ability to control that. And I think that that decision, even though our client wasn't a free software publisher most of the time, is very significant to people who are publishing free software. And although we don't charge people for representation, our lawyers do get paid salary, and we had really excellent people working on that. And certainly donations help us do things like that and continue to have these really great lawyers work for us. So I definitely would encourage people to give us money if possible.
Now, do you have any big corporate sponsors or anything, or do you depend largely on the donations of individuals?
We don't have big corporate sponsors. We have grants from foundations, and we have individual contributions, and those are our major sources of funding. I think that a lot of corporations are uncomfortable with some of our positions, and it's unfortunate because I think in the history of copyright law in the U.S., our positions are not even particularly radical from a historical point of view.
Especially when you read the first part of the Constitution, which explicitly states what the copyright policy of the United States is.
So Larry Lessig is on our board of directors, and he said, if I recall correctly, that he would be thrilled if the United States could just have the copyright law that existed under Richard Nixon, which I thought was a great observation. And I think that most of the people most of the people who work here at EFF would join Professor Lessig in being thrilled if we could have the copyright law that existed under Richard Nixon. And so I think a lot of corporations may have been deterred from wanting to be publicly associated with us because they've heard rumors about us and they've heard us portrayed as very radical or unreasonable. And from our point of view, we're fighting for principles which are properly in the mainstream of American legal and political life, and we shouldn't be seen as unreasonable or surprising or shocking. But we definitely do take rather uncompromising positions. And so a large portion of our funding is from foundations, and a large portion is from individuals.
Now, is EFF U.S. only, or is there an international part to this all, or are there other organizations in other nations that work with you on certain things?
We occasionally speak outside of the U.S., and we occasionally join other organizations in making statements. We don't have any employees outside of the U.S., so if things happen, it's very unlikely that we can go and litigate somewhere, for example. We participated a little bit in raising money for the defense of Jan Johansson when he was prosecuted for his role in developing DCSS. But that, even that is actually fairly unusual. We really do tend to focus on the U.S. I think there are a lot of groups which are getting underway. Certainly we've been working a lot on copyright issues, and that's not the only thing that we work on. We're actually working quite a bit on Fourth Amendment privacy issues and more traditional First Amendment issues at the same time. But on copyright issues, which are sort of the hot thing for the moment, and I think for understandable reasons, there are other organizations which are starting up in other countries. My former colleague Robin Gross has just started a new nonprofit organization in the U.S. called IP Justice, which is interested in international copyright law. And we've met people from, in Finland, there's an organization called EFFI, which is Electronic Frontier Finland, which is not affiliated with us, but we like them. I hope they like us. I know we like them. And in the UK, there's the Campaign for Digital Rights. I had a European activist visiting who said, the problem with the European organizations is that there are really significant language barriers, and so it's hard to start a mailing list and have all of the European civil rights organizations and all of the European public interest organizations get on the same mailing list and coordinate with each other. And so I think the language barrier is, it's a bigger thing than people realize.
Especially when the language is legalese.
Well, yeah, if you want to talk about German law, if you have a casual knowledge of German, that's probably going to be difficult.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping, since the U.S. is unfortunately really actively engaged in trying to export some of the depredations and recent poor choices in copyright law that the U.S. has implemented to other countries, I hope that people in other countries will coordinate with each other really actively to resist that. But I think the language barrier is going to be one difficult thing. There's a lot of action in Europe right now, of course, with the implementation of the EU Copyright Directive, which requires member states of the European Union to implement national law very similar to the USDMCA, and that's very disappointing. And people have suggested that European citizens have some opportunity to affect what that will look like, but it's not clear to me exactly how much effect they can have, because the general framework of the law was set by the European Parliament. So it may be a little late to affect that very much, but I would encourage people to try if it hasn't been adopted in their country yet.
How much does the current world trade environment have to do with this, with these new laws?
Well, it's actually very depressing because organizations within the U.S. try to persuade the administration, to persuade the U.S. Trade Representative that if a country doesn't have copyright law, at least as restrictive as the U.S. copyright law, then that's a barrier to trade, which I think is ridiculous because I think in general having a strong copyright law is a source of barriers to trade. But the policy position that a lot of organizations have been advocating is that if your copyright law is less restrictive than the U.S. copyright law, then you're doing something, you have a deficiency, and your copyright law needs to be brought up to U.S. standards. The funny thing is that it works both ways. If another country has a stronger copyright law in some way, we saw this with copyright term extensions, then entertainment companies will say, the U.S. needs to strengthen its copyright law, meaning make it more restrictive, in order to harmonize with those other countries. And then if another country has a law that's less restrictive in some way, entertainment companies will say, that country needs to make its law more restrictive in order to harmonize with us. Harmonization is never described in terms of making a law less restrictive.
Hmm.
In other areas that aren't copyright, harmonization is interpreted sometimes as making a law less restrictive. I know environmental activists have been very concerned about that. In copyright, somehow it's always interpreted as making the law more restrictive.
It's funny, given what the founding fathers of the United States clearly were writing in the 18th century about copyrights, and Jefferson in particular, and Madison, who came to adopt Jefferson's viewpoint after some considerable debate between the two, and that a less restrictive copyright is probably the best thing for both innovation and for trade.
Well, it is this unfortunate thing. Professor Lessig is really someone a lot of people look to for informed opinion and perspective on this, and I recall that he says we have a conceptual problem because people have this assumption that if some copyright is good, then more copyright must be better.
Mm.
Because it's a very natural pattern of thought that if a little of something is good, then more is better.
Until recently, the United Kingdom has always had more restrictive copyrights. In fact, they've had a history of more restrictive copyrights in the United States. And I think that's probably been turned around now.
So library associations have been very frustrated about these tendencies because libraries are copyright users and they're harmed if copyrights become significantly more restrictive. And they've seen for as long as there have been libraries, which is typically longer than the national governments of the places where the libraries are located, that people just sort of go back and forth and say, but the authors over there are so much better protected. Surely you don't want our native authors to receive an inferior level of protection.
Mm.
And it certainly sounds bad if the authors of your country are less well protected than the authors of some other country. And so libraries have seen for a long time the early versions of the sort of international competition to make copyright law more restrictive. And they've been trying to articulate the idea that copyright is useful, and that doesn't mean that expanding it is automatically a good idea. And I hope that librarians and other such good people continue to find useful allies and coalitions on these things. We've been proud to work together with the American Library Association and the other national library associations in the U.S. They're really good people.
Well, we've rolled past our normal closing time here, but do you have any final thoughts that you want to leave our listeners with?
I would encourage them to try to form unusual coalitions. I'm really concerned because I've been a free software user for a long time, and I've gone to a lot of Linux user groups. And I find that people in the Linux user group are typically fairly well informed about, say, copyright policy issues or internet free speech issues. I can tell them a lot of detail about a particular case that we're working on, but they really tend to know what's going on in a general sense. And I think listeners to this show are probably among the people who tend to know what's going on and tend to know what some of the problems are. And there's a problem because the free software world is very influential and very powerful and very significant, but it's also very insular in a way. There really isn't a tendency to communicate effectively things that are obvious within the free software world to people who are outside of the free software world. And I think this is one of the biggest political problems that the free software world is facing right now. You can write really brilliant code that's really useful and really influential and really important, and if someone else comes along who communicates differently and communicates more broadly, you can get clobbered politically. So I really encourage people to talk about issues that are important to them with people other than fellow free software developers, and to talk about it in places other than Slashdot and other than the online forums where it's just the free software community, because I think reaching out to other constituencies is probably the most significant thing that people can do right now.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Write letters to the editor.
Yeah.
And get them published. They will publish generally any reasoned, well-reasoned, remotely grammatically correct letter. And write your congressperson. If you write your... write letters and do advocacy.
And when you're tempted to join another thread on Slashdot and tell other free software developers about how bad the DMCA is, I would say, at this point, instead of doing that, turn off your computer, go find a librarian or an artist or a musician and tell that person about how bad the DMCA is, because the other people on Slashdot already know.
That's for sure.
Right. And, of course, if you haven't already, this is a good time to go over to the EFF webpage and see if it's possible to free up a little money for them.
For those people who are looking for a rescue system that you can carry in your pocket, I'm one of the lead developers of the LNXDBC project, and we make a mini distribution. And we just released a new version, and EFF is going to be selling disks to raise money for EFF.
Oh, that's
cool. Those will be available from our website. Also, if you become a member of the Free Software Foundation, they'll send you one.
That's very cool. And in fact, let me just throw in there, I did a review of LNXBBC some time ago for NewsForge. It is a great thing for the toolkit, and we all know that, you know, most of the people listening can download and burn their own. But it's a good excuse to get one of the official ones to also help the EFF in this way to actually buy one instead. Well,
this should be available starting this week.
Oh, that's cool. All right. Well, I thank you very much, Seth, for joining us tonight. This has been very informative. And with that, let me throw it back to Kevin.
Thanks
okay.
a lot.
Well, I just want to say thanks to Seth and Dennis and everybody on the crew. We will probably be back next week, although we're following a holiday. So make sure to tell 10 friends about the show and come back and check us out next week. We'll see you later.
While carrying on a game of golf, I may make a play for the cattle, but when I do, I don't follow through, because my heart belongs to that. If I invite I got some knocks to dine out to Boston and Hattie. I do sit your he's asking for more, but my heart belongs to Daddy. My heart belongs to Daddy. Simply could it be bad? And my heart belongs to Daddy. It's bad, 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 bad. What do all you Daddy? So I think you're perfectly swell. My heart belongs to Daddy, 'cause my Daddy, he treats it so well.